You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Time again, MLB.com Extras, National League Central Edition. So much going on in the National League Central, whether it's a new manager in Milwaukee, mental mechanics, breaking those down in Chicago. What's going on with the St. Louis Cardinals off to the best record in that franchise's history? So much going on in the National League Central, and it's all for you right here in the National League Central Edition. Well, we talked about this Cardinals last weekend. Jen, have you caught your breath yet? That was some wild stuff.
It was, you know, three straight days, three extra inning walk-off wins against, you know, what has really become the Cardinals' rival the last couple of years in the Pittsburgh Pirates. So there's no team playing better baseball than the Cardinals, now winners of six straight, 18-6 to start the season. And actually, if they win their next game, it would be the best start in franchise history, which, you know, is no short feat for this franchise history. So certainly everything seems to be clicking. Interesting that this has happened on the heels of losing Adam Wainwright. You know, that being said, I think how the bullpen is going to be able to respond from a heavy workload this weekend and then how the rotation is going to be able to move forward without Wainwright, I think certainly are questions heading into this next week.
Gosh, so much in that answer, Jen. First of all, you're providing some billboard material for the Cubs, who I think a lot of people would still consider the true rivals of the Cardinals. I agree with that sentiment about the Pirates. Hottest team in baseball, there's an argument to be made. There's a team in Houston that might get a little upset over those comments as well. And you talk about the bullpen being overloaded. What about, I think Yadi Molina caught all 35 innings, all extra inning games, all walk-off wins. And I think he caught all 35 innings. He needs a break.
He does. He does. And you know what? Actually, Mike Matheny acknowledged that after Sunday's game, noting that Molina probably was due a day off soon. You know, we can't ignore the fact that, too, this comes on the heels of him missing a couple games because of soreness in his knee. So, you know, he was kind of playing early last week, not at full strength still. Some tightness and soreness in that area from taking a couple foul balls off his knee. So, yeah, I would say I wouldn't be surprised if early in this upcoming series against the Cubs we see Yadi Molina on the bench. You know, you have to consider that this is a stretch of 20 games in 20 days for the Cardinals. So they were going to be built-in days for him at some point, and certainly on the heels of all those extra inning games, I think that'll be sooner rather than later.
I was looking at the box score from Sunday's game, and Sunday's the one that went 14 innings, but Cardinals used 21 players in Sunday's game. But, oh, no, Yadi's not going to get a breather in this thing. It's really remarkable. What a thrilling weekend, though, for the Cardinals. It does punctuate what has been a phenomenal start for this team. And we've talked a lot about the pitching and the depth and just how, you know, how much they appear to have going for them in that sense. But, you know, the Wainwright down, we're going to see another starter on Tuesday. Are they going to continue to tinker and try and figure out that extra spot, or where are they going with that?
Yeah, you know, this Tuesday we're going to see Tyler Lyons, who we've seen, you know, times the past couple years as a spot starter, a lefty pitcher, so another lefty following Tim Cooney last week. You know, right now I think the Cardinals are just trying to have a stopgap there. I mean, it's no secret that they're waiting for Marco Gonzalez and or Jaime Garcia to get healthy. Marco should, you know, if all goes right, be ready earlier than Jaime. You know, the expectation is that Marco pitches in a Triple A game either by the end of this week or early next week, would probably have to make two starts before being considered as an addition for that major league rotation. Jaime Garcia probably about 3 weeks away from being considered. So, you know, in the meantime, they tried Cooney last week. That didn't work out so well, so Lyons will get the try on Tuesday. And the other guy who could factor into this mix over the next couple weeks is Carlos Villanueva. And actually, he probably would have been the starter on Tuesday had the Cardinals not needed him in one of the extra inning games this weekend. So because they needed him to pitch over the weekend, it's going to be Tyler Lyons that we'll see. You know, we've seen some good things from Tyler in the past. The issues for him have largely been fastball command going away at times, and then the innings compounding on him. You know, when you look at what he's done in the majors so far, he's had a few innings that just unravel very quickly and kind of make it a shorter start than desired. So he'll be the next guy up, and it'll, you know, how he does will determine whether or not this is a one-start thing for him or if he'll be able to stay in there for a little while longer.
Okay. Well, you know, look, on the day-to-day baseball front for the Cardinals, that would be the bigger story probably as they just continue to pile up wins. But Let's turn our attentions just for a little bit, maybe for the rest of this podcast, on the franchise four. I mean, what a great franchise to be having this contest with, and everybody's getting in on this, and fans can go online to Cardinals.com, vote for their franchise four. You know, the initial list has eight candidates on it, Jen. Was it easy for you to pick the four?
It was easy for me to pick two. And then I would say from there, I kind of saw four for the last two spots. You know, I think the thing that fascinates me, you mentioned how great a list this is for this franchise, and that has to do so much with the history of this Cardinals organization, is that when you look at the eight guys on this list, they cover 10 of the 11 World Series championships won by this organization. So you really have a representative kind of from each great era of Cardinals baseball, you know, going back to the 20s with Rogers Hornsby and then most recently with Albert Pujols. And most of the players on this list actually won multiple World Series championships with the Cardinals. You know, for me, I think the easiest one is Stan Musial. There's been no greater Cardinal 22 years in this organization, three-time World Series champ, and basically set records, NL records for everything at the time of his retirement, hits, RBIs, games, at-bats, runs, doubles, you name it, he had the record. And from there, I think Bob Gibson was also a fairly easy one for me. Also, like Stan, played exclusively for the Cardinals, part of two World Series championship teams. Obviously, the sensational 1968 season, he had a couple of Cy Young Awards. You know, for me, those two were pretty much gimmies.
Interesting, because everybody knew Stan Musial. I thought you were going to go with Rogers Hornsby. You know, I think the greatest right-handed hitter of all time. You know, and I feel like sometimes he's in the shadow of Stan Musial, and even some of the greats of modern era, like Albert Pujols. But like, tough to find a better right-handed hitter than Hornsby. I mean, Gibson, I can't argue with that. Would Hornsby be on your four, or as you break down the next two spots, how difficult was that piece of it?
Yeah, he is on my four, and I would agree with you, you know, in every regard. I think the thing that maybe differentiated him from both Musial and Gibson to me is he didn't play exclusively for the Cardinals. You know, his 23 seasons, he played 10 of them elsewhere. You know, certainly his 13 years with St. Louis were great. He won an MVP award in 25. He was a Triple Crown winner for the Cardinals two different years. Was a sensational hitter at the time, part of that 1926 World Series championship. So, yeah, I mean, I think he goes down, certainly is down in history as one of the greatest hitters of all time. But again, for me, the fact that he only played about half of his career in St. Louis certainly has him in my top four, but didn't necessarily have him in my top two.
Okay, so that puts then Pujols, and I don't know if it might be a stretch to say Lou Brock. Does that hurt their cases?
You know, a little bit. I mean, Lou was in St. Louis, I believe, for 16 of 19 seasons. So, you know, he was there, and I believe Ozzie Smith was the same, about 16 of 19 seasons. You know, so it's very similar there in terms of playing almost all of their career with the Cardinals. You know, and Albert Pujols, you know, he's an interesting candidate on this list because if he, you know, where he was going when he was here in St. Louis was kind of towards Stan Musial's legacy. You know, he was the guy that many thought could break a lot of the franchise records, the hitting records. You know, certainly I think his departure, his career in St. Louis will go down as one of the all-time greats, but it certainly would be different had he stayed. So he didn't crack my top four, and I don't believe right now he is in the voters' top four. You know, perhaps some of that has to do with still a little bit of ill will for him leaving. I think we all wonder what would have happened had he stayed. Would his career have kind of deteriorated as it has with the Angels, or would he have continued what he had started here in St. Louis? But, yeah, again, the tenure there, I think, puts him a level below where some of these other candidates are.
All right, where does Red fall on the list for you?
Yeah, you know, Red is a special one. I mean, you look just at the playing credentials, he doesn't necessarily match up. But, you know, we're talking about a guy who is now in his 70th season in a Major League uniform, and almost all of those with the Cardinals. So, you know, he was a player here for a long time, a nine-time All-Star with the Cardinals. He then became a manager, you know, the second longest managerial tenure in Cards history behind only Tony La Russa. He was a coach for the Cardinals. He's now an assistant to the general manager for this organization and still has his fingerprints over the current club because he remains a regular presence at the ballpark. So he was a tough one for me, because when you talk about faces of the franchise, I think just the longevity of his presence in and around this organization, he's probably made as big of an impact as anybody. So I think, again, maybe his playing credentials and numbers might not be there, and his numbers were very, very good. But I think you could make a strong argument that he has been a face of this franchise because of how long he's been here.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. What a great list, and what a fun contest, the franchise four. And the St. Louis Cardinals continue to roll, welcoming, well, one of their old rivals, the Chicago Cubs, this week in the Busch. Jen Langosch, as always, thanks for the time. Kerry, always interesting around the Chicago Cubs. Never a lack of storylines and whatnot. This week, and I know it's not like the pivotal item of the week, but I just love it when we get new terminology, and Joe Maddon's good at that kind of stuff. Let's talk mental mechanics and yes. Jorge Soler, because I know that there has to be some concern, and Joe's is good at anybody at sort of massaging these things, but making some moves, I've seen a day off, moving into a leadoff spot, and this is all about mental mechanics adjustments for him. Explain to us what we're talking about.
Well, I think what Joe's trying to do is, instead of having the player think about his physical mechanics, you know, where should my feet be, where should my head be, that kind of thing, just sort of think about the game a little bit. If he's what he wanted to do when he had Soler lead off for one game was to just focus on scoring runs. That was his, so get on base so he could score runs, not get a hit, not hit a home run, but just think about getting on base, which meant, you know, think about his approach at the plate, that kind of thing. It was interesting. Soler got a walk and a single on the day that he was a leadoff guy. And then they gave him a day on Monday, just sat him in the first game against the Cardinals, just to sort of give him a breather. And actually, the Cubs won't say this, but it's not a bad thing for Soler to sit every once in a while. He's had some leg issues the last 2 years, and to just get a day isn't really a bad thing for that physically. And it just, I don't know about you, but I always feel better when I come back after a day off too. So it just could help him a little bit, you know, in that regard. But it's really just, the Cubs have started a whole like mental skills program this year that, it's not that they didn't have it before, but they really promoted it a little bit more and made it more visible. And I think that Joe's just really a big believer in how important the mental side of the game is. And that's sort of what he's dealing with here.
So a mental skills program, what exactly is that?
Well, it's just so that you have somebody, you've got a hitting coach who's going to tell you, you know, well, you know, like I say, your feet should be here, your head should be here, this is how you should do your swing. But the mental skills guy is going to say, okay, how do you deal with these situations? How do you, you know, confident are you? How comfortable are you? What are you thinking about now? I've overheard a few conversations, and they're interesting. The one of the guys will say to the player, what are you thinking about at that point? And just sort of trying to get in their head a little bit.
Huh. Interesting. Sorry,
I need a cough button for a second. Hang on. Okay.
No problem. But with the mental mechanics stuff that he was talking about with Jorge Soler, the idea, too, is stop worrying about hitting home runs. Stop pressing, that kind of thing. If you change the role, maybe you change the mentality a little bit. I remember when I was a lot younger, sometimes the idea was they literally put a quarter in a guy's shoe. So that you would think about the quarter in the shoe and that awkward feeling and stop worrying about, you know, is my toe tap early? Is it late? Is my elbow up? Is it down? I think there might be some real merit to tinkering around like that.
Yeah, and it's, like I say, it's not, you know, guys, there's so many things. I mean, I know when I go out and play golf, I'm trying so hard to make sure that my swing is just right and to line everything up and everything. If I could just, you know, it sort of distracts from just sort of playing the game. What he's trying to do is think, you know, okay, don't think about where your feet are. Don't think about where your hands are. Let's just try and do what you need to do to get on base. And it's really kind of a refreshing way to think. I know, having dealt with Don Zimmer once as a manager, because I'm sure he wouldn't, he'd probably be rolling his eyes right now and spitting tobacco at my shoes. But it's just something that's worth kind of considering and trying.
Yeah. But it's an epidemic right now, this whole issue of power, home runs, whether it's Solaire or, of course, Bryant. You know, we're waiting. Addison Russell finally got his. In general, there just seems to be pressure about the home run ball right now.
Well, and I've talked to some scouts who watch Bryant, and they feel that they've seen him just kind of grip the bat a little tighter, you know, and at bats. There's been a little frustration, although, you know, Chris is getting on base, he's getting his walks, and they're very happy with that. Of course, I think all the Cub fans would like to see him hitting 5 home runs instead of getting 5 walks. It's just a matter of time. It's a matter of him still learning the pitchers, learning how they're going to approach him. The Brewers did a really good job in the weekend series at Wrigley, and I think that other teams are going to watch that video a little bit and see what Mike Fiers did to him and how he elevated the pitches and how Bryant was susceptible to that. And other teams might follow suit.
Yeah, well, I mean, like you said, the time will come for Chris Bryant, and then once that first one happens, Katie bar the door,
yeah.
Who knows?
They're streaky, you know, I mean, and he's, you know, I don't think he's ever had this long a stretch, though. I don't think without a homer. I've been trying to talk to my folks in the minors to sort of give me, and they can't come up with this long a stretch of him going without a dinger. So we'll see.
Yeah, it will happen, though. We know that much. And the team right now in second place in the division, John Lester finally got in the win column late last week. But let's talk a little bit about this franchise four at Cubs.com. Fans can jump on and vote for their top four all-time Cubs. And these are tough assignments even to come up with a list of 8 to choose from here.
Yeah.
To me, there's the obvious shoe-in, you know, Ernie Banks. But I think you can make interesting arguments for just about everybody else on that list. How do you see this one playing out?
Well, I know my husband and I had major debate over this because he found it very interesting, and I found it interesting. And we were debating it before I'd even seen the 8 who are on the list because I wondered if you could write in. And then we started putting together our own franchise for, you know, guys that had been good for us to go to as far as reporters. You know, so like Mark Grace mm-hmm. is number one because he was our best go-to guy. So we were sort of putting together our own franchise four list for in that way, and I don't think that's what the competition is about. To me, it was easy to click off Ernie Banks and also to click off Billy Williams. Billy to me is just, when I watch some of the highlight films and see some of his numbers, they're just incredible. So Billy is a guy that I would also include. After that, it gets a little tricky. You know, how far back do you want to go? Do you want to go back to the old timers? You know, to the Gabby Hartnetts and to the Roger Hornsby, those kind of guys, or do you want to go with Sammy Sosa? You know, who really excited the crowds when he was there with the Cubs too. So, and Sosa, I kind of included in my final four once my husband and I got a little more serious about it, because I just remember the days at Wrigley when he was there and he homered. It was just incredible. He really made an impact.
So those were some exciting days, no doubt. And he was the man. Once again, left with Ron Santo. And it's just, again, it's funny because of the competition here, but there's Ronnie again, kind of on the cusp, in or out for the franchise four for you.
Well, see, I might lean more towards Fergie Jenkins. And I know that's going to upset some Ron Santo supporters, but I think what Fergie did, pitching at Wrigley so consistently and the innings and the complete games, and I guess I would pick Fergie in my group a little bit. I'm a big fan of his. And again, it's not to diss Santo at all. It's just I can only pick 4.
Yeah. Did you have any room for the old timers like the Gabby Hartnetts, the Three Finger Brown, or is it tough for you just to bridge all that time and go back and put those guys on?
Yeah, I kind of went over that, and it's hard because, you know, if you could do like a top 10, it'd be really easy. But here we're talking just 4. I like Gabby, but I also I was a big Phil Cabaretta fan. Mm-hmm. Hank Sauer had had a major impact when he, during his time with the Cubs, although he wasn't there that long. I mean, there's a lot of guys you could. Cap Wilson with the RBI record. I mean, there's a lot of guys you could add to this list. I hope Cub fans take part, and it'd be interesting to see their picks when this is all done.
Yeah, a fun list, and like you say, they could make it 20 deep, and it'd still be difficult. Well,
yeah.
All right, Carrie, I know there's always a lot of stuff to take care of when you're following the Cubs, so I'll let you get back at it. We'll do it again next week. We've talked a lot about the great pitching on this team, and it still holds up as outstanding. But what an incredibly excruciating weekend they just endured in St. Louis.
Well, that's true, but, you know, they're looking at the Cup as being half full. The pitching was absolutely dominant. So it's St. Louis. So, no runs on the Pirates' behalf. They lost three really tough games. But if anybody is an eternal glasses half full guy, it's Clint Hurdle, the Bucs manager. So they came out of it a little bit frustrated, but feeling darn good about the rotation that they had.
Yeah, I think anytime you're pitching that effectively, no matter the wins or losses, you have to feel good about it. But you're right. Clint Hurdle is that guy. I mean, he keeps an upbeat, positive outlook on just about everything. And you've seen, you know, a handful of different personalities over the years in the manager's seat, and, you know, both visiting teams and, of course, home teams. How much of a difference does that make, the way he handles the ups and downs?
It makes a lot of difference. You know, it's almost an everyday sport. You know, you get occasional days off, but for the most part, you're playing every day, and it's really hard. It's easy to get into a dead zone, so to speak, when things are going bad. In Clint, they've got somebody that, even in the clubhouse, always accentuates the positive, and keeps everybody's mind on the next step, not the last step. And I think that's one reason why they have a pretty good history of coming out of these tailspins. The last couple of years, even though they went to the postseason, they've been doing tough stretches, but they always seem to come out of it.
Well, they've lost five of the last six, and I was looking back, you know, they're 12-13 entering this week. And five of those 13 losses are walk-off losses. Now, there is, you know, there's the psychology of a manager who's able to, you know, keep things positive. As you say, keep looking at the next step as opposed to the last step. I like the way you say that. But there is also that psychology of walk-off losses, right? Those can have some impact.
I think there's a definite psychology to the tough losses, but the nice thing, and you know, this is the way I perceive it, and I really think it's the way it's done in the field. The nice thing about playing an everyday sport, when you come out the next day, you really do have a fresh outlook. The psychology and the mental buildup of those tough losses is if you find yourself the same situation in the seventh or the eighth inning, let's say, and say, here we go again. I know we definitely had that feeling in St. Louis because all three games evolved the exact same way. And by the time you got into the eighth inning, certainly after the opener, you know, you're thinking, well, the Pirates just put themselves in position to suffer another heartbreak, which is the way it panned out. But you do start the day with a fresh outlook, with a positive attitude. And the big caveat is not to get into that sixth, seventh inning situation where you feel vulnerable again, but, you know, have a good start and then you kind of build on.
It's an amazing division. You know, in recent years, it's been, you know, there's been so many good teams, and every franchise has had its run in recent years. Cardinals are off to an awfully good start, but because there's good talent up and down in this division, does that temper everything, make everybody maybe a little more comfortable when you go through a tough stretch, knowing that, look, everybody in this division is going to run up against a tough stretch?
I would think so. I mean, the Cardinals, before the Pirates got into St. Louis, played the Philadelphia, which is admittedly one of the weaker teams this season. So they haven't really faced the same tough schedule that the Pirates have had. The Pirates have already played a division-intensive schedule. I know the Cardinals are getting a look at the Cubs this weekend, and they're going to find out how much better that Chicago team is. Definitely a new force in the division. And like you said, you play each team 19 times in the division. They will take turns beating up on each other, and you have to stay on the leader's heels and take advantage of those situations when they get into that tough stretch. You know, the Cardinals have had the same offensive issues as the Pirates are having now. So unless their pitching remains totally untouchable, which is very unlikely, they'll definitely go through a dry spell because they're not scoring many runs either.
No, I mean, even the Reds have struggled scoring runs, which seems almost impossible in their small ballpark. Brewers who struggle, although they've started to turn things around. It's a very, very interesting division. But let's, for a moment, let's just turn our attention to maybe a little more of the history of the franchise. I want to talk about this franchise four, and fans have the ability to go on, go to pirates.com, and they can vote for their franchise four. There are 8 guys on the list, and boy, it's a pretty good list. I noticed they're all hitters. No franchise has had more batting champions than the Pirates, and that's evident in this list. Was your franchise four, was that an easy selection for you to make among these 8 guys?
Oh, it would be. It would be. I think one of the more interesting things about the Pirates' share of that campaign is they do have 4 Hall of Famers who are leading it, but that includes the only Pittsburgh Pirate Hall of Famer living. Bill Mazeroski is on that list along with the leaders, along with Wagner, Clemente, and Stargell. So, I mean, that's pretty darn good company, and also a good recognition for Maz, who, Pirates have a lot of Hall of Famers, as you said, most of them hitters, but Mazeroski is the team's only living Hall of Famer, and he's on that list. Good for him.
When you evaluate the guys on that list, though, I mean, Stargell, Clemente, Kiner, you can throw Wagner and Ty Trainer. I mean, Maz as one of the franchise four, is that a sentimental thing because he's, as you say, the only living Hall of Famer right now for the Pirates? Or
I don't know. I don't know if fans are really aware of that part. I think it's recognition of undoubtedly one of the most iconic moments in this franchise's history. I mean, we keep hearing about it, deservedly so. The Game 7 home run that beat the Yankees in the 1960 World Series. I think obviously he's a great defensive player, but offensively doesn't stack up with the other guys on the list. But I think it's recognition of what he's represented to the Pirates. It's a franchise for what you have brought most of the franchise. And in that regard, I think Mazeroski definitely belongs on that list. Absolutely.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a great list, too, but there's so many names, I guess, that have to be left off on lists like this. Is there any name that comes to mind?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Not offhand. I mean, when you're talking about identification with the Pittsburgh franchise, which obviously this is what it's all about, they've had a lot of great players, but maybe not with the longevity that these, 8 players have shown, and they played, if not exclusively, all of their careers, a significant portion of their careers were with Pittsburgh. And, one name that you could certainly throw in there with Maz, somebody like Dick Groat won a batting championship, was in the World Series team, Pittsburgh native, at least an area native. But he also went to play for the St. Louis Cardinals after left the Pirates. So his identification with the Pirates maybe isn't as strong as, these 8 players.
Yeah, and of course, Bonds on there split the time with the Giants and then had his star-crossed moments at the end of his career. Kind of makes him, that puts him on the outside looking in this group. But really,
The one pitcher maybe I'd have on the list, once again, because of the iconic and significant part, is Elroy Face, one of the game's landmark relief pitchers, one of the first outstanding closers. I would put Elroy on there. But I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't put him on instead of one of the 8 that are on, but I think, he deserves to be on that list. If he was 9, he'd be on it.
Yeah, no, I think so. I'm sure they looked and thought very hard about trying to fit a pitcher on there somehow, but with the great hitters in this franchise history, I mean, you have to go with those.
Put it this way, if you put together another list in 20 years, Garrett Cole would be on it.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, with his start this year, who knows what list he may be on at the end of this season, Tom. I mean, it is unbelievable how he's throwing the ball.
He's really taking, he's taking the lead on that rotation, which has been outstanding, as we said at the beginning.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, Tom, listen, I appreciate the time, and look forward to the Pirates seeing more red this week. They got the Reds and Cardinals at home. Great stuff, man. a very busy time in Milwaukee. Adam, you're home with the ball club. The club is less, a former manager, Ron Renneke, but now with the addition of Craig Counsell, who was hired and announced on Monday. And just to, I guess, start us off with your thoughts of what's going on right now.
Well, you know, the timing was surprising because the move came late Sunday night after the Brewers had, for the first time all season, won back-to-back games, the first time all season won a series, and they make a managerial change. But look, I talked to Doug Melvin after the move, and this was about more than starting the year 7-18, worst in the major leagues. This goes really, in Melvin's view, to the last 100 games that they've played. They were not very good in the second half of last season. They lost 68 of those 100. It was a lot of those losses concentrated last September and now this April. And one of the stunning stats that Doug Melvin brought up multiple times, both last night and again in introducing Craig Counsell on Monday morning, was that three times in the last two-plus full months of baseball, three times the Brewers have even managed to win back-to-back games. And as he said, that was just unacceptable. Now, is it Ron Renneke's fault 100%? Absolutely not. You know, he tried to push the buttons he could push to get the offense going. But the bottom line is, when you're a manager, you are the one who takes the heat for wins and losses. The Brewers' one-loss record was terrible, and on Sunday night, Renneke took the fall. And now a fascinating change to Craig Counsell, who gets a three-year deal and is obviously a part of their future plans.
Yeah, it reminds me of a fantasy football draft, which I'm sure how it most comes up. Fantasy football draft, it's always, there's a run on quarterbacks, there's a run on wide receivers. And I feel like in Major League Baseball right now, there's a run on recently retired players with no formal managerial and sometimes even coaching experience, and Counsell falls into that group. Now, quite honestly, the group that we're talking about, they've all done really well, I think, generally speaking. And I even this hire, it looks intriguing to me. I kind of like it. And I love Counsell's thoughts too, right? I think I'll be better at managing than I was at playing. You buy
yeah,
that?
Wasn't that great?
Yeah.
Here's one thing. I agree with you. There are similarities in the fact that these are all, you know, Matheny, Weiss, Ausmus, Ventura. These are former players who had long careers, were incredibly well-respected, thoughtful, and, you know, when they spoke, others listened. Now, what makes Counsell a little different to me is that he's really been a Brewers employee now for years. He's not coming in cold. He finished his career with the Brewers, and then he has worked since 2012 in Doug Melvin's front office as a special assistant, and this has not been a ceremonial position. This has been really intricately involved in the day-to-day operation of every aspect of the team. So he knows this organization as well as anybody. And what Doug Melvin said today was, not only during all those games on the bench that he had in his career was he managing along, but he sort of has managed along up in the general manager's booth for the last 3 years. So this is not an inexperienced guy. The way I wrote it today is it's true to say he's never managed. It is not true to call him inexperienced. So he's got some former teammates that he's going to be managing now. And the other thing he's got is a team that's playing a little bit better. They won 3 of 4 of the last games with Ron Renneke. They're pitching a lot better. Counsell inherits a team that has gotten 8 quality starts in the last 11 games. There's signs of life. It makes it a very tough move for Renneke from his perspective, but for Counsell, you know, perhaps inheriting a team that is playing up a little bit closer to their where they should be.
It's funny because you mentioned Melvin bringing up that stat about back-to-back wins, and the irony, of course, is that they had just done it for the first time this year under Renneke.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, even as you point out, that you might be playing a little better. You might see the worm starting to turn just a little bit. I mean, it really not as if this has been a 2- and 3-week process where you're really seeing the Brewers starting to click. That said, Braun looks a lot better. You get Carlos Gomez back. Scooter Gennett can't be far off. I mean, Counsell has a chance here, especially just with the recent history now of this team, of really looking like a genius.
Well, I am going to go out on a limb and say that they will have a better winning percentage under Council than they had under Renicky. And with due respect to Craig Council, who I respect as much as any player I have ever come in contact with in this game, it's not going to be because he's some genius manager. It's just because this is a better team than the one-loss record suggests to start this season. To win five games going into this past weekend, they're just simply better than that. So, look, Gord Ash, the assistant GM, gave me a great, interesting history lesson. In 89, his first year as assistant GM of the Blue Jays, they started 12-24. They fired Jimmy Williams, and they wound up winning the American League East. Now, as Gord said, who knows? You can't predict catching lightning in a bottle again. But weird things happen in this game of baseball, and it sounds like the Brewers want to give Craig Council an opportunity to win some games. The trade deadline is still months away, and they're going to get an opportunity to show some signs of life before they start to consider what comes next for this team. Because, as I said, this is a three-year deal for Council. He knows the minor league system extremely well, up and down. He knows what they've got, what potential pieces they have. And if they do shift into more of a long-term focus, he's a good guy to have that be a somewhat seamless transition. But again, the message they wanted to say today is that this is not the start of a rebuild necessarily. The goal right now is to win as many games as they can.
Yeah, well, still plenty of season left. And from the timing standpoint, I get it how Renick you would look at it and think, geez, we're starting to see some improvement. But I always like it when you see moves made with a guy in position to do well. If you're going to call a team meeting, have your ace throwing that night. So, man, it looks bad. Team meeting and team one. And you're going to fire a manager, put a new guy in place? Hey, started with a 10-game homestand. That also looks pretty good for him. But moving on to a slightly different subject, this is going to dominate your week anyway. Let's turn it to something else. How about this franchise four? Brewers have eight guys on the ballot for the franchise four. You can vote for four of them as a fan online. You looking at this list that's up there, is it a pretty clear-cut four for you?
For me, it is. And the first update I saw, I think they got it right. You know, Robin Yount is the face of this franchise. He always will be. He's got the statue outside. He's the kid. Forever he'll be 19 years old coming up and really leading the Brewers resurgence as the 1970s wore on and into the 80s. Paul Molitor, Hall of Fame. He's clearly number two, second best player this franchise has ever had. And then with the update I saw, you had Cecil Cooper and Raleigh Fingers rounding it out. Fingers, of course, another Hall of Famer. And Cooper, who had such great seasons here, 300 hitter every year. And as someone who grew up here, you know about Cecil Cooper in the 82 ALCS, where he delivered the RBIs that sent the Brewers to the World Series for the first time. And he famously chips a ball to left field and kind of wills the ball down. He waves the ball to the grass, and it found the grass, and the Brewers were able to beat the Angels in that series. I think those are very solid picks, with apologies to the likes of Jim Gantner, who played forever and, you know, has a case to have his number retired here, and Gorman Thomas, who's just beloved for being a great character of this franchise. I think those first four are clearly, to me, the cream of the crop for this franchise.
Yeah, I think this contest, too, sort of favors the historical figure more so than the modern-day fielder. What he did as a Brewer stands up with just about anybody, but, of course, no longer with Milwaukee. That hurts him. And then Braun, for obvious reasons in recent years, you know, his legacy will be one that will be colored slightly differently. So it did kind of eliminate a couple of younger guys. I'm with you, though. Coop's a good one. Raleigh Fingers brings a little bit of that similar Gorman Thomas personality and remembrances of that fantastic era as well. So a great pick there, too. But listen, I know you got a lot going on, Adam, a new manager to go take care of. Go show them the ropes, and thanks so much for the time again this week. Mark, let's jump in. The Reds, kind of a mixed bag the last week. Take 2-3 against Milwaukee. They split 4 in Atlanta. Not bad overall. The big news, the big development, though, was, I guess, the final decision on Homer Bailey undergoing surgery, going to be lost for the rest of the year. And, look, good year, bad year. I mean, it's really somewhat irrelevant what direction the team is headed at the moment. That will have an impact on this club.
Absolutely. And, of course, they were counting on having a good year. And one of the reasons why they were counting on having a good year is even though they traded two established pitchers away in the rotation and the offseason, they were really counting on a front line three of Johnny Cueto, Mike Leake, and Homer Bailey. And now you've taken Homer Bailey out of the equation, and it's going to hurt them. They really were expecting him to be fully recovered from the surgery he had in September, and that he was coming back strong, and his spring training workouts and throwing programs seemed to indicate there were going to be no setbacks. So this was a unexpected surprise, and now they have to figure out how to carry on without him.
What kind of a personality or impact is he in the clubhouse?
You know, he's one of those guys. He's a very smart guy. He's a very, I would say, he's definitely a good teammate. He's not one of those dudes that spends a lot of time hooting and hollering. He likes to kind of keep to himself at times. He likes to read books. He's always buried in a book. But he's also one of those guys that's always there for his fellow pitchers, and especially the starting rotation. Those guys are a pretty tight-knit group, and he's become a veteran over the years, and he's one of those guys that's also always dependable when he was kind of, you know, as he became more veteran, that he could be dependable for 200 innings. He was injured a lot early in his career, and then he kind of seemed to get over that hump, and he's been a pretty dependable guy to have in there, and he's been a mainstay now along with Leake and Cueto. So having him not there is going to be tough for them.
So I guess some heightened expectations or pressure, however you want to put it, then on Michael Lorenzen.
I don't know if it's heightened expectations. He can do what he can do, which I know it sounds silly, but he's 23 years old. He's a number four prospect in the organization, and they always kind of knew he would be in the back pocket if they needed to call him up. Would they have preferred perhaps to give him a little more seasoning? Of course, but even in spring training, they liked what they saw. Brian Price kind of gravitated towards him as a possibility towards being a reliever if he could make the team out of camp, or perhaps a starter if something went wrong. And he was in the battle to the end, so they really did like him. And if he's their new fifth starter, I suppose, and if they can whatever they can get for him, that I think will be a bonus. And it's a good chance for him to learn. He's got some power stuff. He learned after his first start that he's going to have to mix it up a little bit. He's going to have to throw strikes. He's going to have to get outs quicker. He threw 107 pitches in only five innings in his debut, and that's got to come down a little bit. But I think this is a great opportunity for him to show and to show the club that he's one of the guys they can count on going forward, and especially in maybe what could be a year of transition next year.
Well, overall, the team kind of continuing to tread water. I think we may have used that term before. They're just kind of hanging in what looks like a really competitive division. And even though the Cardinals, you know, are off to this incredible start in St. Louis, they have their own issues to deal with as well. So we'll see. We'll see how it develops. But let's look for a moment at this franchise four. And I don't know how much you've dug into this, but eight guys on the list, and people can go to Reds.com and jump in and vote for their franchise four. When you look at the names on this list, though, Mark, I mean, it's just it's tough to narrow it to four.
Yeah, it really is, and especially when you look at the candidates, no matter what happens, very likely two Hall of Famers will be left out. Because right now, in the top four is Pete Rose, Johnny Bench, Joe Morgan, and Barry Larkin. And then sitting outside looking in at the moment are Frank Robinson, Tony Perez, Dave Concepcion, and Eric Davis. So it's a remarkably thick field, as they say. And, you know, in the earlier voting, Barry was on the outside looking in, and Frank Robinson was in. So there's obviously some jockeying going on. And, of course, Pete Rose not being a Hall of Famer, but having all the credentials and being one of the most popular players in franchise history right now, this is setting up really good to have quite a moment for him at the All-Star game if he's, in fact, one of the final four.
I remember the last time he was honored at an All-Star game. What name is missing off the list? I mean, you got, 146 years of Reds history and a lot of incredible names and Hall of Famers that have come through Cincinnati. I sympathize with the people who have to put together the list of eight names, because I'm sure you can come up with a couple that should probably have been on this list.
That's a tough one. I mean, I think they did a pretty good job with these eight. I don't think any of them of these eight don't deserve to be on the list. But if I had to rack my brain, of course, especially for these guys before my time. But I know a lot of Reds fans think highly of Ted Kluszewski. His number's retired by the franchise. Gus Bell is somebody that was highly loved, and Tom Seaver had a very nice Reds era of his career here. He threw a no hitter for the Reds. He would be a possibility. George Foster, another member of the Big Red Machine. So there's certainly some people to choose from, for sure. But I really do think if they had to pick eight of the greatest Reds of all time, I'm really racked to come up with anyone that's missing. As far as the pitching, they didn't have the Reds have not had a cavalcade of all-time great pitchers in their organization. They've had some very, very good pitchers. And, Mario Soto and Tom Browning are kind of more my generation that I remember, but even going way back, you had Johnny Vandermeer throw two no-hitters, but he wouldn't be considered necessarily a great pitcher of all time. So I think this is a pretty good group of eight right here.
I was just wondering if maybe a Griffey would get on the list, or going back on Ernie Lombardi, but I do think these things favor the modern era guys, or do you think that there's that history seems to shine more in these types of things?
I can't speak for the other teams, but I think in this situation here, and it's pretty typical of what goes on at Cincinnati. I've lived here since 1990 off and on, and even the 1990 Reds, they won the World Series, and they're being honored this year, of course, for the 25th anniversary, but I really do notice that everything always seems to gravitate back to the 70s and the Big Red Machine, and those are the names that seem to come to the surface first and foremost, and for good reason. Obviously, it was an absolutely prolific decade in the team's history, and it should be recognized. But even now, the Big Red Machine is so prominent in a lot of fans' minds. The comparisons to any team that comes up in the current era always seems to draw comparisons to what happened in the 70s. So maybe in other eras, people's memories are a little fresher. I know I saw Derek Jeter's name among the great eight in the Yankee side. He's outside looking in, but Mariano Rivera was in there as well. So I know some places they think more currently, but I think here it's definitely more in the 70s.
And we might see that test played out really for the final spot in this one between, let's say, Frank Robinson and Barry Larkin. If you had to cast that deciding vote, I hate to put you on the spot like that, man. How would you evaluate one against the other? Very different players, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, having never seen Frank play, I know he's a great, great player. But I also know that maybe his even better years, he was a great player when he was with the Reds, and his even better years were going to be with the Orioles. And I know he's in the top four for the Orioles. So in some ways, he'll be already honored in that sense. So maybe give it to Barry. Frank's numbers are certainly better than Barry's in a lot of ways, and especially in the home run category. So it's interesting. I think the Reds fans, again, the generation before me, they look at Frank Robinson with a tear in their eye because he was traded away in probably one of the worst trades in the history of baseball for Milt Pappas. And I think a lot of Reds fans are very bitter to this day of those of that age. So, but I remember when Barry played, and he was a great player and a great leader. He wasn't the typical, statistical guy that racked up the numbers. Even in his MVP year, he didn't have, outlandish numbers, especially in an era like the 90s where home runs were becoming more in vogue. But he did a lot of great things on the field. So I guess I'd have a tough time, but I'd probably ultimately go with Robinson straight up. But knowing that Frank is going to get in with the Orioles probably, maybe give it to Barry just to get another name in there.
Yeah, I think we can count on Rose, Morgan, and Bench, though, as those three – pretty much locks for the Cincinnati Reds. All right, Mark. Well, great stuff as always. Always fun. And enjoy the week. And we'll do it again in about 7 days.